Hello, this is John Cleese, and you're listening to the Podcast Network.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic. Yeah. It's atomic.
I'm going to make an apology before this show starts. We did the best we could, but the sound quality on a connection between the East Coast of America and South Africa was a little bit iffy this morning. So please bear with us and enjoy the show.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 105. And with me today are Hans and Mary Lou Gauger, my friends, nuclear family, who are currently living and working in South Africa on the Pebble Bed Modular Reactor Project, PBMR. How you doing, Hans and Mary Lou?
Quite well, thank you, Rod.
Very well.
So, Hans, it looks to me from afar like there's some fairly significant steady progress going on with PBMR. I guess the most recent thing I read about was a contract for graphite production and, I guess, parts manufacture. So can you tell me a little bit about what the general status of the project is?
Yes, and not only the graphite, they have been waiting it to award this contract for graphite manufacture, because they were trying to resolve some regulatory concerns with the National Nuclear Regulator here. They did that satisfactorily and then awarded the contract to a German firm. Also, they just recently awarded, my terminology may be incorrect, I had notes on this and I left them at work, unfortunately. They awarded a procurement and construction contract to a Canadian firm, which is a major step toward the actual construction of the demonstration power plant.
Here's an aside. The contract that Hans is discussing is an engineering procurement construction project announced for a joint venture between the Canadian firm SNC-Lavalin and the South African firm Murray & Roberts. End of aside. Back to the show.
So they're on track to break ground for first concrete later next year, and meet their 2014 startup targets.
Now, that contract, I believe, covered both the construction of the demonstration plant and the construction of the industrial-scale fuel manufacturer. Is that correct?
I think you are correct. And like I said, I didn't study very well before I started this thing. But yes, that does sound correct. They'll have a major fuel plant for the PBMR. Right now, most of the operations will be in Pelindaba, which isn't too far from Pretoria. And then the construction, of course, is at the Kuberg site, which is in the, near Cape Town and southwestern part of the country on the coast.
So how far is Kuberg from Pelindaba?
On the order of about 1,000 miles. And that's an interesting question, because the reason that they're rather gung-ho about nuclear power plants and PBMR in general is because the major growth areas, industrial development, is taking place on the coast, Cape Town, Durban, Port Elizabeth, and so on. But their major fuel supplies, coal, are to be found up here in Gauteng, up northeastern part of the country. So you either have to transport large amounts of coal over large distances, as we do in the West, for example, in the U.S., with trains coming from Wyoming full of coal and so on, or you have to build very large coal-burning electricity plants, generating stations, at the mine mouths, and then run high-power transmission lines all over the country. Both of them are less than optimal solutions, so now they want to build more nuclear power plants along the coast where they can use the electricity where it's generated and not have to transport fuel.
Okay, but it sounds like they're still manufacture the fuel up where the electricity is currently available and cheap, and then transport the small amount of pebbles to the coast. Is that kind of the model that they're following?
That seems to be the case. There's a nuclear infrastructure in Pelindaba that's been there for quite some time, and for reasons that I wasn't privy to, they decided that that's a good place to, for the pilot fuel plant at the very least. And when they start building, 20 or 30 of these things for their ESCOM, the state-run electric utility, then they might have to think about other fuel plants. And of course, if they want to sell this technology abroad and sell the fuel for it as well, they might have to build more fuel plants. But right now, Pelindaba is the base of operations.
Now, one of the things that we've always done in the West is really spread our nuclear facilities around. If I remember correctly, we used to mine uranium in the West, move it to the East to enrich, move it back out someplace else to fabricate, shift it all around. I guess the advantage was it was distributed and put jobs all over the place, and it really wasn't moving that much material from place to place.
Now, this demonstration power plant will be burning on the order of 400 pebbles per day, and that's not you could fit that in a large trash can.
Okay, so once the 400 pebbles per day are consumed, what's the plan for where they're going to be stored away?
Well, I'll answer the first part, and then Mary Lou can chime in on the second part. And in the near term, they're planning to construct on-site storage for 40 years of operation. So they'll sit on it for a while until they have a long-term solution, and that's Mary Lou's department.
So the last evolution of the design I heard was there will be tanks to contain the pebbles for the near term, and not for long-term storage, but at the site of the plant. And there will be water cooling for the early years of the fuel while it's hottest, and then we'll switch to air cooling. And then the idea is, instead of having to call the entire pebble, or what they refer to as fuel sphere waste, is to separate the trace of particles from the graphite and just have the trace of particles mobilized in some way in some sort of form that would be a good long-term waste form to mobilize all the nuclides, and then clean up the graphite and reuse it in whatever application is appropriate time.
The idea that we're going to have water cooling initially sounds a little bit different to me. I always thought one of the advantages of the pebbles was they would be able to come out of the reactor and be stored dry. Is the pebbles themselves going to be immersed in water?
No. The pebbles will be in an annular tank. That will be surrounded, the tank itself will be surrounded by cooling water, and this is just to allow them to cool when they're immediately discharged from the reactor core while they are generating quite a bit of decay heat. And then, six, maybe 12 months later, then they can be transferred to dry storage. It's not completely passive, but then again, it's not a safety requirement that it has the water cooling. It's just expedient. way of treating this very hot spent fuel. But their systems allow for considerable air cooling if that's required.
You know, it's interesting. In most markets, people pay a lot of money for heat. But in the nuclear world, we always think of it as something, a challenge to get rid of.
Something to reject, yes.
You know, the market price for heat in the U.S. is something on the order of $7.5 per million BTU. So if we can figure out a way to sell that stuff rather than just reject it.
Well, it would be nice. On the other hand, you know, the quality of heat, the temperature of the heat is critical to its cost effectiveness for various applications. And I really don't know enough about the, you know, desalinization process to know what kind of heat is required. But, you know, if you have rejecting heat right there on the coast with a large power plant and lots of available seawater, seems like maybe you can use a little bit of that heat for making fresh water.
Well, that sounds like a useful thing to have. I'm sure that South Africa doesn't have an overabundance of fresh water.
Well, parts of the country are quite dry. They have some desert regions down here. Other parts are rather wet. It's a very mild climate overall, so it's not like northern Africa, but there are places where water is water scarcity is an issue they have to deal with.
Mary Lou, going back to some of the waste, I think the last time we talked, you mentioned that you had were involved in a research project on some rather exotic ways of taking care of radioactivity over the long term. How's that research going?
Well, the subject is the graphite in particular. It's pretty well accepted that the TRISO particles are high-level waste. Perhaps not high-level waste, perhaps reprocessed at some point in the future, but nonetheless, it's high-level, and that processing that kind of material is pretty well understood. What I'm focusing on is the graphite, which is the largest volume of waste for the PDMR, sort of different than the typical light water reactor that has large volumes of fuel compared to the TRISO particles. But the graphite from both the pebbles and from the reflector block in the core make up quite a large volume. And it turns out, as I'm learning in this project, that it's not unique to PDMR in South Africa. There are hundreds of thousands of metric tons of radio graphite all over the world from other reactors, from the UK reactor, and other gas reactors, RDMK, all sorts of reactors that use graphite. Now, there is actually a European Commission research project of which South Africa is playing a part, in which it's playing a part, for the very reason that people want to clean up the graphite. In the case of the Europeans, it's clean up the legacy graphite to dispose of it properly. In the case of PDMR, it's clean up the graphite so we can maybe reuse it. And the exotic method you refer to is using bacteria to preferentially remove radioisotopes, specifically carbon-14, which is the biggest safety concern and dose concern in the long-term, intermediate to long-term for the graphite.
Now, the
carbon-14
comes from nitrogen contamination within the graphite, is that right?
That's right. Yeah, there is a little bit of professional debate among people in the know, but generally anywhere from 70 to 99% of the carbon-14 that you'll find in nuclear graphite is from the neutron activation of nitrogen. It's an NP reaction, nitrogen proton reaction.
Mary Lou, if I could have you repeat that again. You did have something fly overhead, I think.
Okay.
Anyway.
Sorry, you're having a little professional.
We have professional technical debates, too.
Well, that's okay. You can either keep them quiet and I'll edit, or you can share them and let the world hear your bickering. Professional bickering, of course.
Okay. You want me to repeat what part, Rod?
The part about where the where the carbon-14 comes from.
Okay.
Because just as you were saying that, I think I heard an aircraft fly overhead.
Okay. Carbon-14 is the major source of concern for reuse, for recycle of graphite. So they want to get rid of the carbon-14. It is generally accepted among people who study the issue that anywhere from 70 to 99% of the carbon-14 is created in the reactor through a neutron activation of nitrogen gas impurities. So the nitrogen gas generally is in the outer surface of the graphite, because nitrogen gas gets into the pores of the graphite before it goes into the reactor, or in some cases after it's in the reactor, if nitrogen leaks into the coolant gas and then is activated within the graphite. Some of that carbon-14 can get released from the graphite, especially from the pebbles as they rub against each other, and little bits break off and create dust. Then some of the carbon-14 will be released, maybe as carbon dioxide or just as part of the dust particle. But most of it stays in the pebble or in the reflector, as the case may be.
Our earlier subliminal argument was about the nature of the reaction that produces the carbon-14, and she is absolutely correct, and I'm glad I didn't share it with your audience, because I would have made a fool of myself.
I said that the nitrogen undergoes an NP neutron-proton reaction to create carbon-14, and you tried to tell me it was an N-gamma.
So now she's
not sure. That's all right.
Yeah, of course, that reaction is very important to me to understand exactly how big it is and how frequent it is and how big a problem it is to create carbon-14 for other reasons, because I kind of like using the idea of a pure nitrogen coolant. But anyway, now, well, go ahead.
I was just going to comment that, you know, in my research to learn more about this whole phenomenon, I did read some fairly recent and in-depth reports on the graphite that was used at various reactors in the UK. And some of them, some of the very early ones, were nitrogen cooled, or at least they did nitrogen purges periodically. And so there was a lot of exposure to nitrogen. And so, yes, they had more than we expect to see in the pebble bed. I don't know how that would have affected operation, because I was clearly just focusing on the graphite issue, but what I surmised was that there was a larger concentration of carbon-14, but it was in forms that were not as easily released. It was more it tended more to stay with the graphite as opposed to go off into the coolant. So what that's worth.
This is an issue that PBMR is very interested in right now, and that is the generation of contaminated dust. And you won't have it as a serious problem, or at least the source of dust in the reactor, in the Adams engine, it does not come from the abrasion of pebbles. You put the pebbles in and they sit and they cook. Whereas the pebble bed, PBMR, the pebbles are circulated through the core constantly during operation, up to 6 times per pebble until they are discharged. So that constant rubbing of 400,000 graphite pebbles against each other causes the generation of dust in the primary coolant stream. Now this dust is mainly carbon, but whatever fission products or things like carbon-14 that comes from the activation of a contaminant will be a part of that dust. And if there is some sort of major leak in the primary system, that dust can be dispersed throughout the confinement building and become a radiological concern. Now, if you're using nitrogen in your reactor rod, then you'll get direct conversion of nitrogen into carbon-14. So that will show up as a dust as well, but that's dust from a different source. But it's the same problem. The carbon-14 is not a major radiological concern in the nature of the beta radiation emits. It's a low-energy beta. But the sheer quantity of it and its availability or the ability to be dispersed in dust is a concern. And PBMR's interest in recycling and therefore Mary Lee's project is because they would like to return it as feedstock to produce more graphite blocks and pebbles down the road. And most of the graphite, none of the graphite manufacturing operations around the world are really geared up to handle radioactive material. So there are many issues tied up with this graphite contamination, carbon-14 issues that Mary Lee is addressing.
The graphite manufacturers haven't seemed very interested in recycling graphite. I guess they want to continue selling new graphite. Is that the case that you've run into?
Well, I had just very limited exposure to this, and it's through that European Commission project that I mentioned earlier. It's called CarboWaste. At an inaugural kickoff meeting that the group had at Jülich in Germany, we had representation from, I guess, what are considered the two big suppliers of graphite in the nuclear industry, SGL and the other one escapes me now. I think it begins with a K. In any case, it might pop into my head. But they're representatives from both of those companies as part of this research project. But my manager was spending a good bit of time talking with them, trying to, you know, just get a feel for their company stance on what they would want to see, they being the companies would want to see in terms of material coming from PBMR to put back into their process to create, you know, new structures or pebbles or whatever. And they seemed really unable to even process the idea. I think they were very, very narrow in their visions for what the company does. And, well, we get raw material and we make good stuff from it. That's kind of what they were thinking. And we were trying to make the point that, well, if we expand this concept and we build lots of reactors, then we need lots more graphite. And I'm sure you would agree that the supplies, the raw materials for what you do are not infinite. And they conceded that point, but I think they were just, it's just a little too soon for them to wrap their brains around the recycle issue.
You mentioned there's quite a lot of
graphite that's legacy graphite from other projects. And I know part of what you're talking about is the legacy pebbles from the German thorium high-temperature reactor and AVR. Have there been any efforts to reduce the size of the waste in those forms, you know, by separating the graphite from the TRISO particles?
The lead researchers on the project are, in fact, scientists from Jülich who the very top lead of the project, Werner von Lenze, his office is in the AVR building. So they're very intimately familiar with those reactors and the nature of material from those. When we were there at Jülich, we were able to witness part of the
decommissioning of the ABR, which is very interesting.
If you go to the Atomic Show blog, you can find some photos of the decommissioning of the ABR that Mary Lou shared with me.
And we were told about how they were taking the pebbles out. It was my understanding that the pebbles were going to be secured as it is, and there wasn't going to be any separation. They didn't think that there was anything really to gain from separating that. And plus, it was a much smaller volume than we'd be looking at from the PBMR, especially if we were to scale up and expand.
But there is a fairly significant number of pebbles where one could do some experimenting on how to grind them up and separate the graphite from the trisoparticles, and if one had that desire to figure out the long-term effects, maybe, you know, the South Africans can buy a few pebbles. I'm sure the Germans think of them as waste products.
Yes, there has been some of that. In fact, we're waiting right now to receive some irradiated graphite from Jülich for our research purposes. And yes, there have been a number of studies on the best way to separate the trisoparticles from the graphite.
One of the big projects that's going on related to graphite is some cleanup of the Magnox facilities in Great Britain. Were they part of the conference?
Yes, they're a huge part of this group. In particular, well, there are a number of entities from the UK, but one group in particular is at the University of Manchester under Professor Barry Marsden, and he's known to be quite a specialist in graphite chemistry and properties and so on. So he's leading up some parts of the various work packages in this research project. So yes, they're very involved, and I haven't seen a breakdown of what percentage of this overall quantity of graphite goes to the UK, but I get the impression that it's a significant minority, if not a majority of it.
Yeah, some of the earliest reactors in both the UK and in France, I believe, were gas graphite reactors. If I'm not mistaken, they were even cooled by air to begin with.
Yes, that's right. And France is also a part of this project, and there are a couple of Eastern European countries involved as well. So I think most of the countries in the European Union that have efforts along the line of what to do with their graphite waste are participating in this project.
How about the U.S.? Do we have any involvement?
We don't. And the main reason for that is because it is a European Union project. The only reason that South Africa was sort of allowed to participate is because we aren't actually part of the grant. We aren't getting any money like the rest of the countries are to do any work. And we are bringing in the sort of the opposite perspective of, while everybody else is looking more at what do we do with this legacy material to get rid of it, we're looking more at how do we clean it up to reuse it. And they thought that was a valuable perspective to have as the part of the whole project.
Of course it's a valuable perspective. Some of those people that want to get rid of it may find out later on that it's better to sell it than to get rid of it.
Right.
Because if I'm not mistaken, the process for producing nuclear quality graphite is not a cheap process. It does require some significant processing to get rid of neutron absorbers in the feedstock, which I believe is coal to begin with.
Yeah, coke is, like, as I understand, the main source. And sometimes, for example, the matrix graphite used for the pebbles, they use some coke and then some graphite powder. So they use some already graphitized powder plus some raw coke, apparently, and then they mix it with a resin. But there is quite a lengthy process, as you say, to remove as many impurities as possible. And even so, you're going to have some impurities. But a lot of people are suggesting that when the nuclear graphite comes out of the reactor after it's been radiated, it's actually even better neutronically and in terms of reactor operation than it was before. So it would be foolish to get rid of it because all of the neutron poisons are burned out now.
I can understand that after being exposed to neutrons for a long period of time. The stuff that absorbs neutrons is probably done its absorbing.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Especially the reflector graphite. It really has little other contamination. You know, it's got the carbon-14 and maybe some tritium, but it really doesn't have the opportunity to get much exposure to what the pebble graphite might see with some possible actinides and fission products.
In the safety analysis for the pebbles, is there any thought that the graphite matrix provides some amount of protection from the release of fission products, or is it just focusing on the coatings for the TRISO particles?
My understanding is they take a little credit, very, very little credit for the retention properties of the matrix material. Once it gets outside the silicon carbide layer, it migrates through the graphite. It's not a quick migration. It's not an instantaneous release, and the matrix graphite indeed does retain some of the undesirable materials. But for their safety analysis, conservative safety analysis purposes, once it's released from the silicon carbide TRISO particles, and they can usually assume that it's going to be into the coolant.
I think it varies fission product as well, because the properties of the matrix are more likely to impede some migrations and not others. I mean, obviously, silver is the one that is quite the thorn in the side of gas reactor operators because it just goes right out. But the other species are easier to immobilize.
I think as they test more graphite fuel and develop some acquire some operating experience with the demonstration power plant. In fact, this is one of the primary objectives of this demonstration plant is to actually look and see what kind of migration they're getting. Because despite the fact that ABR ran for 20 years and THTR ran for 2 years or so, the database of knowledge about fission product retention and so forth is still has some gaps in it, and they want to take a look at the fuel coming out in the graphite blocks as well to see what's really happening, so they can refine their models, improve their correlations, and then maybe they can go back through best estimate techniques and capture back some of that conservatism that they're assuming now. That will allow them maybe to go to higher temperatures or higher burnups and so on, or otherwise relax their safety requirements. But at this stage, they can't take a lot of credit for retention in the matrix.
Are they getting any help from their competitors in China?
My understanding is no. They're congenial competitors. The Chinese are largely focused. They're not trying to beat PBMR to the marketplace as much as they're just focusing on their internal market, and they don't have time to play around with the South Africans. Of course, you know, individual scientists on the project are welcome interaction and expansion and sharing of knowledge. But there isn't a lot of formal collaboration between PBMR and China.
Well, of course, the Chinese are operating a pebble reactor today, so some of that data that you're talking about in terms of retention and migration, I would imagine, could be captured if the sharing arrangements were happening, or if the Chinese were actually taking the data. They may have found that it's not a big enough problem to worry about.
That could be the case. You can go to some of the German scientists who worked on the HGR project 20 years ago, and some of them will tell you, oh, it's a no, never mind. And others will tell you that this is a problem that, you know, is a major regulatory concern. So it just is a reflection of the lack of a strong, you know, major database on this particular topic. But, you know, ABR ran for over 20 years, and they had a water ingress accident. They had, you know, as you know some of the details of how they operated that thing. They routinely shut this thing down just by turning off the primary coolant blower. So they stressed out the fuel, and they had considerable amounts of dust in their primary coolant loop, much more than they had anticipated, or much more than they expected when they started the decommissioning. But obviously it wasn't a major safety concern. No one was injured or no workers were exposed during that time. So it's a regulatory concern. It's something that has to be managed, but it's not a showstopper.
Now, please don't take this the wrong way, since I know you're both scientists. But typically, people whose job is to solve problems spend a lot of time going around looking for problems that need solving, rather than saying, well, it's not a big issue, let's move on.
Yeah, well, I'm with you. I'm of the minds that you do what's necessary to satisfy the regulator, and then anything else, if you can afford it and want to, go ahead. But it's not something that I want to spend my life studying. I love things I like to do.
I had that same sort of perspective, Rod, because when I was first assigned this project, I think had a healthy skepticism about the process as a whole, but even more fundamental than that, my question was, well, how necessary is it really to clean up the graphite? Carbon 14 is such a low energy beta emitter. What's the problem? But I became convinced that it's not so much the fact that it's carbon 14, but that it's such large quantities of carbon 14. Large quantities of graphite, that it becomes unmanageable at that point. So I agree, you do need to look at the big picture more often, I think, than a lot of scientists do.
What I found in my line of work is that sometimes you have people who actually go to the regulators and say, this is really a problem, isn't it? Please write a regulation to make sure that somebody has to solve it, so that I have a job.
Well, in fact, PBMR deals with such issues occasionally. In fact, there's going to be a recent issue. A paper was in publication, I should say, it hasn't been published yet, by a senior researcher at one of the research institutions in Germany that's caused a little bit of a gnashing of teeth, should we say, in the pebble bed reactor community, because it really takes a very pessimistic view of pebble bed reactor technology in general. And you know, it's something that the regulators will look at seriously and say, well, what about these issues? And the scientists and engineers say, well, just give us some money and we'll go off and we'll model this thing to the nth degree and maybe we'll change the design a little bit. The client, the utility that's looking for electricity is saying, you know, let's get the thing built. We'll work with the regulators, to resolve these issues, but let's get the thing built and run it, and then we'll deal with these problems as they come up. So it's, you know, everybody's got a little different perspective on it.
Yeah, there's no such thing as producing electricity without issues.
Right.
So, like you said, you learn an awful lot by actually building the systems and determining, once you're operating, which ones are really issues that cause concern. You know, the people that own and operate the plant don't want to hurt their employees. They don't want to hurt the public, but they do want to produce electricity and sell it.
Yeah, and you know, I was thinking about this the other day. There are people. There have always been people in the anti-nuclear community that will latch on to a technical issue that's an unresolved technical issue or certain uncertainty. We don't understand that process well enough, so we should not proceed with this technology. But it's, you know, if you look at it like an automobile, before, you know, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, before there were airbags, we had seatbelts. They worked pretty well. And then this idea of an airbag came along, and it was tested. It was modeled. It was found to be a dramatic safety improvement. And you put it in. Little did we know that, you know, 10 years later there would be concerns raised about the explosiveness of the airbags and how rapidly they would deploy, and that could cause neck injuries and so on. So does that mean we stop testing or implementing improvements as they come along? Certainly not. This is progress. If you didn't allow technology to develop because the technology was not yet perfected, then there would be no technology.
The airbag issue is a very interesting one. I lived in Central Florida for a long period of time, and the inventor of the and the patent owner for the technology that allowed airbags to deploy automatically and that kind of stuff was a company called Breed Technologies, which developed in Central Florida. And the owner of Breed Technologies spent a tremendous amount of time working the regulatory circuit to try to get the technology to be mandated. And initially, the automobile manufacturers resisted, but at one point, Lee Iacocca from Chrysler recognized that if the airbags were mandatory and everybody had to put them in, then it would not be a big problem for the car companies because they would all make a little bit of profit by installing one more device in the cars.
I'm going to put a link in the show notes to a 1983 article from Nader.org that specifically promotes the Breed Corporation's airbag sensor. My personal belief is that this is a link between someone who has a safety technology to sell and a famous agitator whose business is to help ensure those kinds of things get mandated by the government. Not a bad way to increase sales, by the way. End of aside, back to the show.
So lots of money changed hands, but it was not always directed at improving safety.
Right. Well, I just like as with airplanes as well, you know, if whenever there's a crash or some kind of deficiency is noted, some people regard that as a justification for further regulation and so on. When in fact, the airlines and the automobile manufacturers know the bottom line implications of preventable deaths as well as anyone, and they don't want to hurt their customers. So I'm a big believer in market corrections to safety deficiencies. I think they work much better than regulatory actions, which usually come on afterwards.
I agree. But sometimes the industry that is built up of scientists and engineers who design ways to automatically or some sort of means of preventing an accident or an injury or whatever, like the regulations because they can get their products to be considered to be, quote, the best available technology. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting phrase that's used in a lot of regulations in the U.S., particularly for things like atmosphere control or emissions control or those kinds of things.
And it raises, as you well know, barriers to entry to smaller competitors. And it's one of the reasons why we have only two or three worldwide vendors of nuclear power plants.
Speaking of nuclear power plant vendors, have you paid any attention to the discussions with the nuclear suppliers group related to sales to India?
Only just a few email briefings that I've read. I'm really not up on the issue.
Yeah, that's a pretty interesting one. I guess there was some late-night discussions last night. I've got to do some searching and find out if how those came about. But that's an interesting discussion because India is a huge potential market for power plants.
India represents a very interesting challenge, and I confess I really don't understand the ins and outs of it, even though I had an association with former ANS President Harold McFarland, who was instrumental in carrying out a delegation, being part of a delegation to India. But it's complex with the non-proliferation aspects and uranium scarcity and thorium and so on in India. It's an interesting case study in proliferation and potential use for nuclear energy.
So let's get on to a more personal level. Mary Lou and Hans, how's the power situation down there? You guys had any blackouts recently?
You know, we haven't had the load shedding, as it's called here, since January or so. Occasional outages, but they're not scheduled as much as, a local substation fails or something like that. So, no, our power has been fairly steady for a while. The main reason for that is that some of the major industrial concerns, the largest consumers of electricity from the coal plants, worked out deals with Eskom, the electricity supplier, to reduce their consumption either by cutting back on production or finding ways of working more efficiently. And that has allowed the rest of us to go with uninterrupted power for quite some time. And that wasn't just out of the goodness of their souls. Eskom kind of really cranked down on that a bit because the load shedding that they had been conducting in around the December, January time frame was wreaking havoc on their electrical infrastructure. The switch gear, the substations and so on just could not handle that constant switching on and off, and it was falling apart. So they had to find other ways to reduce demand. And they're also having better luck with keeping their coal plants up and running. They're not having as many unplanned outages. They're getting their coal supply issues worked out. So they're tightening up the ship a little bit. But I'm afraid we haven't seen the end of load shedding. It's South Africa's economy is growing. People are enjoying higher standard of living, and that's made really made possible by consumption of electricity.
So how do the kids like living in a foreign country?
Oh, they're, I think, learning and experiencing something new every day. Clearly, the culture is very different. The biggest change for them is the schooling, which is quite a change for them in terms of number of students, type of education, the racial mix of students and teachers, the sorts of backgrounds that the people come from, income levels and so on. So they're now faced with very large classes, very traditional education that's really more based on the British system of sitting at the desk and everybody doing the same thing at the same time and having periodic tests. And they grade the students and test them really almost like they would be high school students, and they're only in grades 4 and 5. So it's pretty strict that way. They're also learning some life lessons that, people steal, people lie, people bully you. They were a little bit sheltered from that back in Idaho Falls where they were going to school. So it's not always a fun lesson, but it's an important lesson along the way.
Now on the upside, they have made friends The people here are quite friendly and they really kind of welcome us and the kids, like the kids. And so it's been a positive experience overall.
And again, we've came here for a number of reasons. I mean, the driving force was Hans' opportunity to work with Pebblebed, which is true love in terms of technical work. But there was also an opportunity for my research, and with that also an opportunity for the children to live in a foreign country. And so we've taken advantage of our weekends to go and see things. 2 weekends ago, we went to an elephant sanctuary. It's only about an hour's drive from here, where elephants that are separated from their families for whatever reason go, because they're very family-oriented animals, and if they don't have a family to grow up with, they don't grow up well, and they kind of don't know what to do. So they kind of raise these elephants to a certain age, and then they form their own sort of family units, and then they're set out into a game reserve somewhere. But we got to meet and touch and even just rode the elephants. It was quite an experience, and you just don't have that opportunity in Idaho Falls.
Rob, maybe I should send to you a short video that we took of Mary Lou getting kissed by a young bull elephant. And
he had a crush on me.
It is something to see.
You might I can understand that.
You add it to your website.
Yeah, I was, you'll see when you see the video, but he gave me a kiss with his trunk, and his trunk kind of, the end of it covered the whole one side of my face, and, he was a sucker. I thought half my face was going to be gone, and when it was over, I was covered with dirt and elephant snot, and it was great.
Rod, getting back to your earlier the earlier point, it dawned on me, some of your listeners may be interested in a tour of duty like we've done, and I'd strongly recommend it. Just yesterday, my supervisor sent out an email asking for internal recommendations for people to help with all aspects of power plant and reactor core analysis. Expertise in criticality safety or thermohydraulics or reactor physics or dust and dust modeling and so on. If any of your listeners wants to undertake kind of an adventure like we have been doing for a short period of time or a longer period of time, I think there are some tremendous job opportunities down here. You're welcome to contact me via my email address, and I can help hook them up with somebody at PBMR, and I can guarantee that it will be a very rewarding opportunity.
I think you attracted some folks, and I didn't give you permission to advertise, but that's okay. One of the things that has happened for the Atomic Show recently is that one of the major utilities in the U.S., Entergy, has decided to begin advertising on this show and to allow me to talk a little bit about some of the opportunities that are available there. They're a pretty far-looking utility. It's pretty unusual to think of a typical electric utility with rate-based generation and traditional pension plans. Looking out and saying, we need to attract some folks into our company, the right kind of folks, people that are thinking and learning and, listening to podcasts on the web, maybe just the kind of people that we want to talk to. So they've asked me to talk a little bit about their company and their fact that they're splitting off part of their nuclear business into a very specialized nuclear utility, which would be the first one in the U.S., called Nexus. They can operate 5 plants in the Northeast as a separate company. Pretty exciting opportunity.
I'm watching that with
Yeah, it's something that I've been watching. Of course, Entergy right now is undergoing one of the tough challenges of a traditional electric utility and having to rebuild their electric power grid after a fairly significant hurricane. Gustav apparently knocked power out to about 840,000 customers, and they lost a lot of transmission lines and distribution, and have to send people out in some pretty, you know, challenging circumstances to go put that power back up so they can serve their customers. Anybody who's interested in learning more about Entergy's opportunities should go to nuclearenergycareers.com. Or if you're interested in pebble bed reactors, talk to Hans. I'll see if I can get his email address and put it in the show notes.
I will provide it to you. Or you have it. You're welcome to put it up.
Yeah, I'll put it up carefully so that it's not clickable, because I don't want you to get a bunch of spam because you're on a website somewhere.
Thank you.
No problem. So one of the things, going back, I want to redirect a little bit to the dust issue. As you were talking about that, I remembered a discussion that I had sitting in Andy Kadak's office in Boston, Massachusetts at MIT. He showed me a pebble that was not the black pebble that I have, but a kind of silvery pebble that had a coating on it. I can't remember what was used on that, but I guess there have been some research in the pebble bed reactor field about actually putting a coating on the outside of the pebbles to reduce some of the dust issues. Is pebble PBMR looked at those at all?
Yeah, I think it might be. Well, Mary Lou's shaking her head, so obviously she's got some inside information that I don't, but I know it's been talked about for quite some time, and if this dust generation thing turns out to be a significant issue, then a special coating might do the trick.
There is, in the current production specification for the fuel sphere, or the pebble, an outer coating. I don't know if this is akin to what Andy Kadak showed you or not, but you know, there is the matrix graphite that encases the TRISO particles, and then there's a layer around that of graphite that's somewhat of a buffer and a protector, and then there's a very thin coating on top of that at the very outside, and I'm assuming that part of the reason for that is just to make it more robust as it goes through the reactor. It is all graphite of some kind. It's all carbon-based.
Right. It's highly polished. That gives you the silvery sheen that you've seen. I've seen those pebbles as well. But Mary Lou says it is all graphite. But I have heard talk of zirconium carbide and some other type of exotic but inert materials that would be would withstand the climate inside a pebble bed reactor, withstand the abrasion, and also you have to look at the for burnout modeling. This is one, you know, the areas of interest to me. The friction between pebbles will impede their motion relative to one another, and motion relative to the graphite reflector walls. And if you've got a high degree of friction between the pebbles and the walls, then you can get drag forces impeding the motion of these pebbles. So some of the pebbles near the walls will be rather slow moving relative to the pebbles right in the middle of the...
At this point, the fan on Hans and Mary Lou's computer got so loud that I had to stop and try to get them to... let their computer cool off a little bit, and we came back to the conversation. It was the point where I was losing some of what you were saying about the drag.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen a demonstration, I guess it was a computer model, of the flow of pebbles through a cylinder. And I'm not sure that it was actually, I'm trying to remember where I saw it, whether it was actually designed for the pebble reactor or some other moving bed of spherical elements, because that's not completely unknown industrial phenomenon.
Right. And the flow of particles inside of a pebble bed or inside of any kind of container is of interest in many other fields as well. For example, a lot of the analysis probes that are used to model pebble flow were adapted from those developed by the mining industry to model the collapse of mine walls and ceilings and so on. What's not understood well enough are the properties of graphite pebbles at those temperatures and conditions. What are the friction factors that can affect the relative motion? But the Germans did a number of interesting experiments early in their high temperature reactor program. Some more recent research is being done at MIT and elsewhere that looks at the flow of pebbles and how much variability it is, how well it can be predicted, and so on. And the computers have advanced to the point where you can model each individual pebble using basic laws of physics and simulate the behavior of the pebbles in the flow stream. So it's an interesting area of research. It's not, again, a critical path item for PBMR, but it's something that does affect the fuel performance and something that they have to look into.
What kind of burn-up does PBMR think they're going to get?
The standard, according to the fuel spheres that I've been studying, is 6 passes per pebble through the reactor at 98, I believe it's 98 megawatt days per kilogram.
Yeah, of heavy metal. Or not, I think the basic equilibrium core model targets at about 92. You know, there's quite a spread in there because of this motion of the pebbles. So it's up around the 90 to 100,000 megawatt days per kilogram of heavy metal range, which is significantly higher than light water reactors at this time. Of course, it's starting with a higher enrichment as well. The enrichment of PBMR fuel is coming in about 9.5% U-235.
Typical light water reactor is about 40 to 45 megawatt days per kilogram, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
So roughly doubling.
You double the enrichment, you double the burn-up, and it's mainly a function of the buildup of fission products and the stresses on the coatings. There have been tests in the AVR by the Germans of fuel that was burned to much, much higher, you know, hundreds of megawatt days and burn-up. Those might be eventually introduced into a PBMR core as well.
Yeah, General Atomics is still very interested in deep burn type testing. I've read quite a few of their presentations and papers about somewhat different TRISO particle with a little bit less fuel and a little bit more coatings to allow them to get to much higher burn-up.
And the Department of Energy is funding some research through my former and future employer, the Idaho National Laboratory, and others to look at this in general and in the context of the GNET program, because it is one way to reduce inventories of minor actinides, particularly plutonium, is to burn it out more thoroughly in a high temperature reactor. And it does require some very clever designs for the fuel particles to capture the neutronics of burning these plutonium and other minor actinides. But yeah, General Atomics has been kind of the vanguard of that effort.
Is that discussed much in the discussion about the waste stream, Mary Lou?
I mean the concept of burning up or reusing the fuel particles?
Well, if you can, you know, pass the core, pebbles through the core more or get more power out before you take the pebbles out of the core, eventually that means the waste stream is smaller, right?
Yeah, clearly. I think that's more a cross-discipline subject.
in terms of overall reactor design, and as Hans mentioned, efficient running of the reactor, you know, balancing fission product buildup and wear on the pebbles and buildup of dust in the power conversion unit and so on. Clearly, you want the highest burnup you can.
Right, from the point of view of the waste stream, but obviously you have to balance all the costs and factors. But it's an interesting opportunity, and I think that it's one of those things like Hans is talking about. The real thing is to get the reactor, the demonstration reactor, up and running, and then work on the refinements as you gain operational experience. That's what my current employer has always done, which was, the Nautilus Corps got about 5,000 full power hours before it was replaced. Current corps last for 33 years without replacement.
Right. And there is a bit of a tension, I guess. It's probably not the best word to use it, because it's a very productive and constructive environment. But, the ESCOM, the client, wants this plant built right away, and other clients as well. For example, the Sasol company is very interested in this technology for driving their coal to liquids technology. And they're not interested in the science projects. They want a heat supply. They want it now. But the scientists and engineers at PBMR, they say, we want to put in flux measurements in the core. We want to instrument it here. We want to perform this kind of experiment there to refine our estimates of reactivity coefficients and so on. And, we want to make this a demonstration, a research reactor. And so they have to come to some reasonable agreement. But I think they all understand that, the important thing is to get the plant up and running soon, and then we can play around with it later.
And right now, soon is still defined to be sometime around 2014, is that correct?
Here the fan kicked in again, so I cut out some of that noise.
The tension between those who want to study and those who want to do is a healthy one that has always been associated with nuclear power. Unfortunately, I think that we've, for a long time, been a lot more aimed at those who want to study rather than those who want to do.
Yes. And that's certainly been the case, for example, with our Department of Energy projects. I'm not sure that you can describe any reactor project the Department of Energy has had is anything but a research project. There is strong commercial pressure, and I think that commercial pressure to build these plants and get them operating as power plants and not as interesting engineering projects will only intensify in the coming years as the cost of fossil fuels increases and the demand for energy continues to increase.
Yep. And I for one, can't wait to see an operating PBMR so that we can learn as much as possible. And of course, I also know that once the plant is operating as a commercial plant, the opportunity for learning is going to be a little bit less, or maybe even quite a bit less, because the company that owns and operates it will want to retain that knowledge as part of its competitive advantage. But that's probably also a little bit of attention in the project that you're operating.
It is. There's quite a bit of international interest in the PBMR, and I know the Department of Energy and the Idaho National Lab would love to have access to the research and engineering that PBMR has achieved and is planning to conduct. On the other hand, the taxpayers of South Africa are investing quite a bit of money into this, and they have a right to expect a return on their investments, and that can only come if PBMR holds the intellectual property. So you know, they'll have to juggle that and balance those interests as they go along, and we wish them great success to do that.
At the same time, that they're clearly cognizant of what's their intellectual property, they also are very active in promoting, supporting students at the various universities in South Africa, sending students overseas to the U.S. to do research, and sharing that information. So while the students may be doing research as a benefit to PBMR, it's clearly, you know, open source knowledge, as is anything that it's done at the university. And that's the sort of work that I'm doing now, where, you know, I can take part of it, for example, back to INF, and they're encouraging me to strike up a collaborative sort of arrangement with INL, Idaho National Laboratory, so that we can have projects going on both sides of the Atlantic, and have exchange of information and overall more progress in that way.
Healthy tension.
Yes.
And knowledge, I think, is something akin to love. The more you share, the more you get. Unfortunately, there are commercial interests that don't necessarily understand that they want to kind of hold everything tight. They don't realize just how much you give up if you don't share, if you don't build off of each other and stand on each other's shoulders. I mean, the patent and trademark provisions in the U.S. Constitution are prefaced by to expand the arts and useful knowledge, you know, that we will put in a system of patents and trademarks to give for a limited period of time.
Here's a specific text from the U.S. Constitution from Article 1, Section 8, which goes under the heading of Congress shall have the power to, and it says, to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited time to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. End of constitutional aside. Back to the show.
And unfortunately, some of our commercial enterprises in the U.S. think that limited should mean something in the terms of, you know, almost forever. You know, some copyrights are lasting now for 100 years, where it used to be just a few years. Maybe, I think 17 years is what a patent lasts, and that's probably long enough as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think to a large extent the people in PBMR understand they need to interact with the international community. They have to interact with their customer base, and they have to promote this. And you can't promote this technology and gather public support for it unless you show some of your cards and get people excited about the potential of this technology.
Now, the PBMR is going to be about 165 megawatts, is that correct?
Yes, electrical.
Electrical. And is PBMR looking at installing groups of units at the same location so they can be controlled by a common control room? Are they looking at individual units, or how do they visualize they're going to deploy these?
I think that the long-term business plan is to sell them in groups. As you discussed in the previous part of it, you can build incrementally. You build one or two plants initially, and you build up to a six or eight pack as demand requires, and once you get to that point, then you can always be operating. That plant, that generating station, can always be producing electricity and not be going down every 18 months or so, because you can shut one down for maintenance and the other five continue to run and just rotate in that fashion. So yes, it is the PBMRs that's part of the purpose behind the modular approach to the PBMR. And it is that you can just crank these things out in small amounts in a factory parts and so on, and put together these little clusters of reactors depending on local demand. And I think that eventually, with the right regulatory environment, the business climate will favor that sort of approach to nuclear power.
Pebble bed reactors, that is, or the PBMR particularly, is the online refueling. Is there a thought that at some point, as you learn more, these will be able to run for not 18 months, but 24 months, 36 months, 48 months without shutting down?
Yes, I think for the demonstration plants, they're counting on a 90% capacity factor. They'll have to shut it down occasionally to replace the reflector blocks and other maintenance tasks. But the real advantage of online refueling is a very high capacity factor. It's just constantly running, and you don't need to shut down to refuel. They can if necessary, but they don't want to.
Very good. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you guys as always. It sounds like you're both learning a lot. It's interesting that you shared the recruiting message. I think that there may be some other listeners who are interested in that kind of opportunity to live and work in an exciting, dynamic environment for a period of time. I know the PBMR project is one of the largest science and engineering projects ever attempted by South Africa. And matter of fact, probably one of the largest nuclear research teams in the whole world at this point. He's focused on a single project.
And they're planning to build many more of them. They expect a demand for high-quality engineers to be sustained in this country for some time.
That's great. Mary Lou, any final thoughts?
Thanks for talking to me. I'll be happy to check in a few months down the road, too.
You got it. All right. Thank you very much, and you guys have a great day.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need. Something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. Mm-hmm. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. Mm-hmm. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.